Hello there, and welcome to the podcast. It's John Markar here, and I thought I'd just jump in with a very quick but very important message that I wanted to share with you before you delve into this episode of the Driven Chat podcast. This podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now come to an end. But don't worry, I'm not going to stop you from listening to this episode or from catching up with the 185 episodes that we've recorded in this format. I just wanted to let you know that if you're looking for our new episodes recorded after December 2023, then you'll need to seek out our new podcast, The Driven Podcast. You can find The Driven Podcast in all the usual podcast platforms, including, chances are, the one that you're listening to this one on right now. So please do enjoy this episode, share it with a friend by all means. But when it's done, don't forget to search for the new podcast, The Driven Podcast, and subscribe to the new format to hear the new stuff. To make life easy, head on over to the Driven website via driven.site. There you will find links through to the new podcast, including links to your preferred podcast platform. And hey, whilst you're there, why not check out everything else we do, including hand-picked automotive news stories, car and bike reviews, video features, and even more. For now, though, I'll let you enjoy this episode, and I will remind you again at the end of the episode, but for the future reference, this message is approximately 1 minute and 30 seconds long. That's 6 clicks on the 15-second skip button. Enjoy!
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my name's John McGurk and I am director of McGurk Performance Cars.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
Hello and welcome to this week's Driven Chat podcast. My name is John Markar and I'm joined this week, as you've just heard, by another John. It's John McGurk, who runs a rather fabulous company called McGurk Performance Cars with a, I'm going to say, an emphasis but not an exclusivity on Aston Martin.
Very well worded, yeah.
Thank you. Okay. And I've decided I wanted to come and have a chat with John today because, well, in fact, we first started talking about the possibility of having a conversation with each other for the podcast in November 2020, which, and before we hit record, it really does fly. Because I was thinking, I remember it well, because I know that it was Remembrance Day. It was the 11th of November when I was driving up, and I was thinking, oh, that doesn't feel like it was last November, but it wasn't. It was the November before. But yes, we have since got sidetracked. And
Easily done.
These things happen. Now, we first met at Cafe in a Machine, didn't we?
Of course.
Because you turned up in a rather incredible, I'm looking at a photograph of it on the wall, Ferrari F40.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think in our conversation, we do have to talk about that because it is my absolute all-time favourite car.
Yeah.
And I suspect it might be one of yours as well.
Do you know what? Nobody even knew I had that car until Cafe in a Machine existed.
Is that right?
Well, I just kind of keep myself to myself with it, really. I'd take it out very quietly and just disappear off somewhere and then put it back away again. And then all of a sudden, it's become quite a thing.
Yeah.
Understandable because it is a thing.
You know? It is a thing. And it's quite unusual, isn't it? Because a car like that, you tend to find that people that own stuff like that often do want to shout about it, about look at me, look at my cars, look at my wealth, that sort of stuff.
Yep.
So yeah, it's quite refreshing for suddenly an F40 to turn up and then somebody sort of tapped me on the shoulder and said, oh, this guy lives down the road. And I'm like, what? Like, why haven't I seen this before?
Yeah.
It really was down the road.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll get to that later. We've got a lovely list of conversation talking topics that we're going to get through, and I think we're going to get some rather interesting stories today. So I'm excited to dive in. But before we dive into the point by point, why don't you give us a really quick overview of where you are right now, as in McGurk Performance Cars, and what you do, and then we'll dive into it in greater detail a bit later on in the chat.
We are an Aston Martin specialist, and as you quite rightly said, it's not exclusive Aston Martin. So we do buy and sell all sorts of weird and wonderful. So in our showroom at the minute, I've got a Ferrari 550 Maranello, we've got a Jaguar XJ220, I've got a XKR. We've got different things as well as, but Astons are our thing, and there's no doubt about that. And the more emphasis we've had on Astons, the bigger that's become. And the building that we're in now originally was the showroom, and that's now morphed into a workshop. And the building next door has now become a showroom. Yeah, I mean, we roughly speaking, we sell about 200-ish used Aston Martins a year. Our workshop is an extremely busy part of all of that. And it's all sort of, it's a very heavily orientated part of the business, and it's become a real force, much greater than I'd anticipated. And now sits alongside the sales side of the business, and they both march along, really.
Got you. Did you set out to be a dealer over a service shop, or a service shop over a dealership? Or?
No. It was always about buying and selling cars. Mm. But the point was, when we were selling Aston Martin, we'd say to the customer, sir or madam, we'll take your car to Aston Martin. They'll service it and maybe even put a warranty on it, and we'll present the car to you in that way, and that's the best we can do. Mm. But the issue with that is that the more and more of that you begin to do, the cost of all of that, you know, to give it to somebody else to do, it just becomes greater and greater and greater. And I got to a point and I thought, you know, this isn't working. We need to do our own thing. We managed to grab a technician who was from the factory. And we started with one, and then it became two, and now it's three, and that's plenty, really, for what we do. Just in terms of our building size, in terms of managing it, and being able to deliver what we want to deliver. So, it's become quite a thing.
Yeah, and it's a big site here. You know, it's quite hard in audio format to explain, but the last time I was here, we had a quick walk around and saw that beautiful showroom of just. Yeah, how many cars do you keep in there on average?
Between 30 and 40. So yeah. The showroom's about 8,000 square feet, and the workshops are 3,500 square feet. But as always, you always want more space.
Yeah.
And at the minute, we've got a growth problem. And you know, we need more space, and we're sitting here scratching our heads, and I'm thinking, what on earth am I going to do now? And you know, and all that sort of thing. So just another good problem to have, of course.
Yeah,
so,
indeed. Yeah. Ultimate first world problems, definitely. Right then, let's dive into how you've got to where you are now, because I love a story. I love knowing. I think me, like so many of our listeners, have this huge passion for the automotive industry. The thing that we've spoken about time and time again on both the podcast and on the radio show, and even in some videos as well, is that what I love about the automotive industry is we're all here because we love cars, or we love bikes. We love things with engines and things that make noise and things that go make a mess.
Yeah.
That's why we're here. It is a passion-led industry in every aspect, from car design through to technician, through to selling, through to PR. We're all in this because we love cars. Nobody's really here going, oh, I don't really like cars, but I'm going to work on them, because that'd be a really weird thing to do.
It doesn't work. Yeah.
So let's find out where this passion and this journey started for you. I'm going to assume there was perhaps some parental influence as a youngster.
No, actually, quite the opposite. In fact, if we talked about my dad's car history, that would be absolute carnage. Champagne beige Metros with brown interior, green Volvo estate, 245 DLs or DL and a GLT. Again, champagne beige with an awful brown interior. So dad didn't excel himself with cars until much later on, although he did try and restore an E-Type once upon a time, which was a complete disaster. I think that what kicked it off for me when I was younger is we lived in a village called Brinklow, which was just outside of Coventry. And in Brinklow, there was this chap called Malcolm Cramp. And Mr. Cramp was an engineer. And had an Aston Martin, and he had, as it turned out, and I didn't know at the time, a DB4 GT lightweight, a really very, very, very rare car, which at the time, when I was 10, which I think was when I first saw it, roaring up through the village, the noise this thing made, it was kind of a silvery blue colour, he used to drive the wheels off it. I mean, he didn't care one jot. Of course, everyone mistook it for a DB5. Mm. When you're 10, you're none the wiser. But it looks like it's a Sean Connery car.
Yeah.
You literally on a Sunday, I'd be on my bike, ride into the village, and I'd hang around to wait to see if he might drive past in it, or I might cycle past his house and have a quick look, see if it's parked on his driveway, and have a little chat with him over the gate or something. That was the car, undoubtedly, that really got my interest in all of it. And Mr. Cramp he had a Mini Clubman, in typical engineering style, had a 1410 fully blown A-series engine, and he used to scream around in that as well. So, when I was 17 and I had my Mini, it was my first car, I'd do my damnedest to chase him around if ever we happened to coincide. So that was the car. And I think as well at the time, you know, when we were younger, I mean, Formula One for me at that time was such a thing. Mm. Such a thing more for me then than it is now, for loads of reasons which we're not going to bore each other with. But I think all of that was, yeah, that's enough, isn't it, to kind of to light the fire, yeah. Really. And then it was, you know, how do I get my first car? I'm 14. So I'm 14 years of age, and of course I'm at school, and I'm stood there talking to a couple of mates as we got off the bus, and we're all winding each other up, saying, right, how are you going to get your first car? And it's like, is your dad going to get you a car? I don't know. And one of the guys went, oh, my dad's going to get me a car. And I was like, oh, my dad's not. I thought, right. So, of course, we decided that even to go home and ask our parents. And the thing is with my dad, you had to catch him at the right moment. So we'd be sitting around having dinner, and dad's got him from work, and he's got a glass of wine on the gun. I'm looking at him thinking, this is a good moment. So I said, right. I said, Dad, you know, I'm going to be, you know, 17 in 3 years and what have you. And I'm thinking about a car, and what do you reckon, Dad? Sort of thing. Come on, you know, what do you reckon, Dad? And he's looking at me out the corner of his eye with this kind of little grin on his face, and he's looking at me thinking, here we go.
Yeah.
You know,
been waiting for this.
Yeah. So he said, I'll have a bit of a think about it. So of course, we all went into school the following morning, and different feedback from different kids about Dad's told me to get stuffed, or yeah, Dad, my dad said he's going to get me a car. It was all over the place, and my dad came in on Friday evening. Same week, and he said to me, I've been thinking about that car problem that you're going to have. And I'm like, all right. He said, well, he said, tomorrow morning we're going to go see a man about a car. And I'm like, really? And he said, I want you up, dressed, ready to rock and roll. We're leaving at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning. We're going to see a man about a car. And I couldn't sleep all night. I'm absolutely beside myself. And so the following morning, I'm downstairs. I've made him some toast. You know, I've got him a coffee on the go, and he sits there. And he's reading the paper, taking his time. And he must have been laughing, yeah. at the way he was going on. And we got in the car and we drove up the road and we pulled into this restaurant that every now and again, Mum and Dad went to. And he said, and I'm thinking it's the kitchen porter's car or it's the chef's car or something. And we pulled in and we got out. And we walked in the front door, and Dad introduced me to Paco, the Spanish restaurant. And Dad put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Son, this is Paco." And Paco said, "Hola, how are you?" You know. And Dad looked at me and said, "Paco, I've been talking about your car problem. And we reckon if you work here every Saturday morning, every Sunday morning, for the next 3 years at £1 an hour, which was the going rate at the time, it's £3 a shift, you'll just about be able to afford a car." And Paco had a bit of mop and went, "Off you go."
Brilliant.
And that was it. So I stuck it out. I stuck it out. Yeah, I did. And I worked there, and I quite enjoyed it. You know, it was my first job, and off I went. And it was either that or I'd go. I was always going around the village with like a bucket and sponge and washing people's cars for a quid. Bobber job, as it was known, if I remember rightly. Yeah, that was that.
And so that ultimately led you to a Clubman that you bought? Or
it
just,
wasn't. It was just a Mini. It was a 1000cc, again champagne beige, which was the seemed like a family theme
very
at the time.
Very on vogue.
Which started out as a beautiful one owner little car, and I've still got the number plate on the shelf here, and I've still got the original set of keys for it. But of course, I was 17, and you just want everything to go faster. So the 1000cc engine got replaced for a 1310 engine that we built and threw in it. Then the car got crashed. I crashed it. And then it got rebuilt again. The next thing, like, it's got these sort of revolution four-spoke wheels with the chrome rims, and I've got the centre big exhaust, and yeah, it did all of that. You know. I took the rear seats out and put speakers in. I mean, you name it. We did all of that, really.
What I love about that story is there will be many people listening right now, me being one of them, that is kind of nodding along going, yeah, tick, tick, tick.
Yeah.
I've done all of those things. First car was Mini. I crashed it as well.
Yep.
Admittedly, my dad was a little kinder in it, but there was a bit of a compromise because my first car being a Mini, Dad did the typical dad thing as a teenager. What do you want to do after you finished education, work-wise? The only thing I could think of, my dad was in the motor trade for as long as I can remember. He was a mechanic as a child. He then went on to work for Snap-on Tools. He's still in the motor industry now. So the only thing that kind of came naturally to me was, well, maybe I'll just be a mechanic. You know, I like tinkering with things. I like taking things apart. That's what I'll do. And Dad, even at that time, so we're talking early to mid 2000s here, at that time was convinced that the automotive industry, from a technician's mechanic point of view, was going to be awful. we're all going electronic, or there's going to be so many computers on the car, there'll be nothing to fix. I think that was his thought train, even back then. So perhaps a little bit ahead of himself. But his compromise was, we'll find you a car, a Mini, something a bit rubbish that needs some work, and then I'll teach you everything you want to know about mechanics, as long as you promise me you don't become a mechanic. So that was that. So yeah, we got this little Mini, and yeah, sure enough, on went the wrong wheels with the wrong exhaust and the wrong speakers.
Absolutely.
All of that nonsense. And I had a little coming together with a Fiat Cinquecento in a Saturday job car park that I had. So
I had a massive coming together with an Armco on the Coventry Ring Road. And the car understeered. It was New Year's Day. I was off to work in the hotel, which is what I was doing at the time. It was 6 o'clock in the morning, and I went under the bypass up the hill. Car understeered, and I lost control of the car, and it snaked. As I fought with it, it snaked all up the hill, and then I hit the side, like the Armco, which below it was like a 60-foot drop. And as I hit it, both my headlights ejected out of the front of the car whilst lit, and then faded as they went down to the floor below. And I'm screaming in the car thinking, what on earth am I doing? And that was back to the drawing board for the Mini again. Never mind.
Yeah. Oh. So was that the end of the Mini there?
No, it was back to my dad's garage at home where, you know, I'd taken over the garage by this point, much to my dad's frustration, and me and a couple of mates, and we cut the wings off it and we jigged it and put it all back together and we painted it in the garage. We did the lot.
Brilliant.
And, you know, as you do.
So a strong start with I've got a note here as well. So crashed and rebuilt. So that's your Mini story.
Yeah.
There's a note underneath called Christmas car.
Ooh. Yeah.
What's that story?
Yeah. Okay. So. When 17, obviously, and we were all kind of learning to drive. If that makes, we'd all got licenses.
Yes, yeah.
But when I say learning to drive, I mean we're learning how to muck about with cars.
Absolutely.
So, three of us would get the Coventry Evening Telegraph and flick through the ads in the back for a car. We got a budget of 50-ish quid. It had to be taxed and MOT'd. It had to be rear-wheel drive. Holy Grail was the 1.6 litre Capri or Talbot Sunbeam or something like that. That was just a bit of fun. And I mean, we lived out in the sticks, right? And I stress that you cannot do this now, but at the time, you kind of got away with things a little bit more than you can now. And we'd take this car and we'd rally it around the lanes. I mean, we'd be in the middle of nowhere. We'd be sliding the car and doing all sorts of stuff with it. But ultimately, we always ended up in the hedge. because we just weren't that good. And we'd stick it in the hedge, and we were climbing out the passenger window, out the boot, or whatever it was. And then you'd walk to the nearest pub, spend the whatever 5 quid you got left, but you always had to keep the tenner you needed for the farmer to tow you out the following day. And that went on for a few years, you know. And it was great fun. And the idea was then, when it got to February, you'd advertise the car back in the paper again and try and get your money back and all that sort of stuff. And that was our Christmas car. But yeah, we always went shopping for a Christmas car. Every year, like kind of mid-November onwards, and yeah, but it had to be rear-wheel drive, and it had to tick as many boxes as we could. But yeah, it was good fun.
I'd love to. So, what sort of cars are we talking there? I'd love to think about what value they might be at now if they're still on the road. Was it anything relatively interesting?
Well, I mean, no, not really. I mean, these are bangers, weren't they?
Yeah,
I mean, they had to be road legal, you know, and all the rest of it. But, you know, ultimately, if we took a wheel off or dented it or something, it's not going to be the end of the world.
Yeah.
And if it's worth 50 quid, well, now it's worth 40 quid, well, you know, whatever. but they that was good. So when it snowed, you know, icy roads, when it snowed. I mean, one of the things that my mum and dad did for me when I passed my test was send me up to, I think it was up near Donington actually, and there was a school there where you could learn about skid control.
Oh, brilliant.
And the great thing about it was that they used Mark III Cortinas.
Uh-huh.
On a car park, and they just chuck oil everywhere.
Yep.
I mean, again, you can't do that now either, but they chuck oil everywhere with water, and you drive around this car park on bald tyres, learning about cadence braking, learning about the physics of what happens when you tap the brakes, what happens, you know, the transfer of weight, all that sort of stuff. And then at the end of it, the instructor chased you. So the idea is he's forcing you to try and make a mistake. And
it was
brilliant because, you know, if you can't control your car in the rain, you know, aquaplaning, all that sort of stuff. And It was, yeah, that was really good fun to go and do.
I bet.
Yeah.
Completely lost art now, I feel. Because I think unless you really go out of your way to go to do car control days, or if you can find a skid pan somewhere, if, you know, if not many left now, but even let alone those that you can go and actually pay a fee to go and enjoy. Unless you're doing that, or unless you're very fortunate and you can afford to go ice driving once a year or so. I feel like with modern cars being so good, and you know, everything now has traction control, everything's got stability control.
Yeah.
I just think that the vast majority, 90% plus of drivers on the road would have absolutely no idea what to do now.
Not a clue.
And it's such a shame, isn't it? It's scary in a way.
Yeah, and even ice driving's not, you know, because the cars are geared for it. Suspension setup. I mean, the car is designed to do that.
Yeah.
And what we're talking about is we're talking about taking a car that's designed to cruise down the dual carriageway at 60 miles an hour, and all of a sudden we're going to stick it on a load of ice. Well, you're in that. You know, you're going to be in a whole load of trouble.
Yeah.
I mean, it's important just to understand.
That's it.
Understand what happens if I do this. What happens if I break? If I'm aquaplaned, do I break? No, you don't. Do I? You know, No, you don't. Just sit. You know, just keep it steady.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
A lot of the time, it's you know, when you go from being, you know, when you go from having grip to having no grip, it's, you just got to worry about your steering wheel and just leave your pedals alone and close your eyes.
Close your eyes and hope for the best.
Yeah.
Right. So the journey from that point onwards in car ownership, because again, I've got a little list here. I'm cheating because I've got a little list. So I can see some exciting cars here on the list. Where did it go from there? So you waved goodbye to Mini.
So yeah, the Mini went in favour of Mark 1 Golf GTI, which, you know, at the time again was holy grail of, you know, how do I, it was £850, and I bought it from somewhere up in Derby. Drove it back. It got a body kit on it, which I didn't like. So I loved the original look. So the body kit went in the bin. The wheels that were on it weren't right. They went in the bin. I put the P wheels on, standard front, spoiler at the lower valance. In fact, actually thinking about it, I remember I bought the car and drove back from Derby. And as I came into the village and turned up the little lane that we lived on, it lost drive. You know, and I'd been and bought this car privately, and I was 18 and whatever else. And I'm sat there in the middle of the road with my pal that was with me, and I'm thinking, oh my God, what have you know, the gearbox is gone, or this is gone, or that's gone. As it turned out, it hadn't, it was a drive shaft that snapped. But you know, it was just one thing after another. But yeah, it was. I loved that Golf. It was fantastic. As it turned out, it had a TSR, Tim Sales Racing, I think they were called, engine upgrade. It went like a rocket. It was a great car. And I just love the look of the Mark 1 GTIs, really. And unfortunately, somebody else liked the look of it too, and it got nicked, which I was gutted about. I think I'd had it for a couple of years. And I definitely had it a couple of years, and it got pinched from Sainsbury's car park. So I had the Golf was a goner. But it was, that was a really great car, actually, super reliable and, yeah. A lot of fun.
And the birth of the hot hatch, really, wasn't it? It was certainly at the
And the 205. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, the 205s were great as well, but the Golfs were a bit bigger and heavier. But I just quite like the look of the Golf. And, it's quite a nice car to have, much to my parents' dismay that I'd gone and got a quicker car than my last one, you know. So, it's a good car, that.
What was the perception of... So, I mean, you don't have to reveal any ages here, but what era are we in here, roughly?
93.
Okay, yeah.
So 93.
So at that point, it is... I'm trying to compare, like, if that would be... Was the Golf GTI at that point looked at in the same way by the car community as, say, the Golf R is now? Was it seen as this, like, absolutely rapid thing?
Yeah, I suppose it must have been. I suppose it must have been. It's funny to think like that, isn't it? But then I think back in the day... You know, Max Power magazine was on the shelf. So it was a different world back then. And the Golf, it was always Golf GTI, Nova GT, Astra GTEs, that sort of stuff. And it was what can you get insured on? What can you get away with? And I don't think that as an 18-year-old lad today, I'd be able to have insured that car at that point in my life, really. And... I don't know, but yeah, I just like the Golf, really. Yeah. Probably not the quickest thing out there, thank the Lord. But great fun to mess around with camber settings on the front of the car. So there's lots of bits with the car you could play with and what have you. And I liked it. It's a good car.
And then it got faster because I see the next car on the list Escort RS Turbo.
Yeah, I don't know if it did get faster because I think the Golf was a much better car.
How interesting.
I think the Escort in a straight line, if the clutch could have held together, because it had been it had been mapped and mucked about with, and I think if the clutch could have held together, it might have gone quicker. It definitely went quicker in a straight line, but couldn't go around corners like the Golf did. The Golf was a great handling car, and the Escort wasn't a great handling car really. And it had been painted like this metallic blue, and it got different wheels on it, and it had an exhaust you could stick your head in. I mean, all that sort of stuff, you know. And again, it was a really good fun car, but the Golf was the better car. Yeah, definitely.
Amazing.
Yeah,
amazing. And then I got my next note here is company car. So I guess at this point you're getting into work. Are you still in hotel world or have you moved over to cars here?
So I came to my senses. The hotel trade at the time wasn't regulated like it is now. And as a trainee, assistant manager, deputy manager, whatever it was, you get flogged to death. And you know, yeah. It was 110 hours a week. I mean, it was absolutely. Yeah, it was, I remember coming home on Christmas Day one afternoon, and you know, Mum had got some lunch leftovers for me, and I just curled up on the table and went to sleep. I mean, it was exhausting. And I loved cars. And next thing I know, I managed to get myself a job as a trainee salesperson at the Rover dealership in Coventry. Mm-hmm. So selling secondhand Rovers, which I've got to say was just one of the best jobs I've ever had. It was just superb. It was a great time of my life. I was 20-ish and I loved it. I did. I mean, you know, it was as always with these jobs. I think we did 12 on and 2 off or something.
Right.
But, you know, but having come from 110 hour a week.
Yeah, of course.
You know, it gets to 5:30 in the afternoon. The guy's saying to me, you can go home now. I'm thinking, really? I've got another like 8 hours in me if you want it. And, yeah. You know, but it was, that was a good job. It was good fun.
And how was that transition from hospitality? Did you find sales quite easy as a result of having worked in a field where yeah. you're having to look after customers constantly?
Yeah.
Because I often find that. It's quite a common journey, actually, I find. For people that have worked in hospitality or even the travel industry have then gone into cars, and they've always found that, you know, you can walk into any sales job and get training, but if you've had no experience in how to deal with people, then often you're not going to be a very good salesman. It's that old saying, isn't it? People buy from people rather than the product. Did sales come quite naturally to you then, do you think?
Yeah, because it's people skills, isn't it? Yeah. It's just being able to hold conversations with people and not be a salesperson, but be an information provider and just do it in the right way. So when you go from being in the hotel trade in the city centre of Coventry, which, you know, at one point was one of the most violent cities in the country. Mm. So when you go from dealing with nice people, obviously, but also dealing with the drunks, the yobs and all the rest of it, and you're dealing with all of that, and then all of a sudden I'm dealing with nice people that want to treat themselves with a new car. It couldn't have been more one extreme to the other. You know, and some of the shenanigans that we used to have to deal with in the hotels at the weekends and the nights, I mean, it was tough going. So all of a sudden, I'm stood out on this used car pitch, as we used to call it, selling Rover Metros to whoever, and it was great.
Yeah, yeah, I bet. Oh, fantastic. Yeah. And then I've got my next note is Ford. So...
Yeah, so I did the car sales thing, and then I wanted to do the finance thing. Mm-hmm. So I got a job working at what was Corner Ford in Coventry at the time as their finance guy. So all the people that bought the secondhand Fords, I was the guy that did all the finance.
Okay.
And what have you. And did that for a year, did very well at it for 12 months, but the business wasn't being run that well, as it turned out, the alarms were going off when the guy that ran the business summoned everybody, all the staff, to come and have this meeting. And he said, "Look," he said, "I'll get you." I think it was like he was offering an extra day's holiday per car that you could bring in from your family.
Wow.
And we're like, we're all scratching heads. And as the finance guy, I understood about, you know, stockings and the stocking facilities and stuff. And I'm listening to it thinking, this doesn't sound good. And he's saying, if you bring in like your mum and dad's car, you'll get 2 extra days holiday. And I'm thinking, how many cars do you want? And it turned out he needed quite a lot of cars. So all of a sudden, there's clearly something going on with the finance company where he's taken more money from the finance company for stocking cars that he hasn't got to prop up the business. And I'm thinking, right. So we all left the meeting. I rang my dad and went, I think I need to get out of here quick, you know. Yeah. And sure enough, that all folded not long afterwards. But it was a shame. So I found myself in no man's land for a minute. So I got, there was a car supermarkets were becoming a thing. Mm. And I ended up over in Northampton helping to set up this car supermarket, which was all finance based. It's all mm-hmm. about, you know, selling finance to people. So I went and did that for a short period. And then, as luck would have it, I had a phone call from the guys at TWR, again, which is back to Coventry, saying, you know, would you like to come and work for us? And I was like, yeah, absolutely, I would. So next thing I know, I was at, you know, at Jaguar TWR in Coventry, which again was just brilliant. And I have to say that working at TWR and the way that business was run at the time is how I am doing this now, because it was it was great standard setting, very much eye for detail, but you know, doors always open, come and have a coffee, and customers would come and go, and you had that great relationship with people. You're taking your time with people. It's not in and out as quick as you can. Mm. And that was a really, really well run business. And at the time, we got involved with XJ220 quite a lot, because, of course, they were hanging around a little bit. And that was super exciting. And all of a sudden, I'm at Brands Lane talking to people at Jaguar at the factory about these cars. And I'm just, all of a sudden, I mean, we're in car heaven.
Yeah.
You know, so it's gone from being about car sales and about finance. And all of a sudden, it's just... it's just exploded into this. I'm being surrounded by TVRs that were in part exchange and all these cool cars that started appearing out of nowhere.
Mm.
And yeah, that was an exciting time. Yeah.
Amazing. And just to fill in the gap for anyone that's listening that's not familiar with TWR, so that is Tom Walkinshaw Racing.
Yep.
And at that, and I'm guessing that was the dealership that had been set up in his name, or by, it was by Tom, wasn't it?
Ixion was the company that it all went under, and the Ixion Group had a number of businesses in and around the Midlands. The TWR Jaguar one was the one that stood out, because, of course, of Tom's relationship with Jaguar, with racing, the XJSs, and so on and so forth. So that was kind of a flagship place to be, really.
Did your paths ever cross?
Only when I won an award for, again, it was the finance thing I was doing, we had a quick hello and a handshake at that point. Mm. But he was too busy doing Formula One teams and things, and
yeah, of course,
you know, doing lots of cool stuff like that.
Yeah, awesome.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital.
Oh, that sounds good. I do love. I still occasionally see an old Jag XJ6 rolling around with a TWR all slightly folded and rippled over time.
Yeah.
But it's such a cool thing to see. In fact, a good friend of mine, Dan, we in lockdown, when everyone in the world was furloughed and we could have little bubbles, we decided to start a little, start a little business where he was sort of buying and selling interesting second, third, fourth, sixth hand cars. And we ended up going up to Doncaster to look at this XJ6, and sure enough, it had a TWR number plate on the back, and that was pretty much the reason we bought it. Because it was like, it's come from TWR in Coventry. It's amazing.
It was quite a brand.
Yeah,
you know? And people always wanted to have the jackets and, you know, be part of it. It was a very good thing.
Amazing. Right, so TWR, and then after TWR, I've got Graypole.
Yeah, so Ixion was bought out by Sytner.
Mm.
So all of a sudden, you know, we had the Sytner team descend upon us, and very professional outfit, and there was a vacancy. Graypole at the time was this lovely little quaint Ferrari dealer tucked away in Loughborough, and it had literally had a cave out the back, with this sort of extended showroom, and was always described as an Aladdin's cave, which is sort of a phrase used quite a lot, but it really was. And next thing I know, I found myself at Graypole, kind of doing a sales manager / business manager finance role. It was because the numbers were much smaller. It was a very much a much quieter footfall, so you end up doing a bit of everything. And what a wonderful place to be, you know, sort of in the showroom surrounded by all of these amazing, you know, bright red pieces of art, frankly.
Yeah.
And at the time, the 355 was the car to have, mm-hmm. And the 360 was just around the corner, and you know we were learning about all of that, and a really exciting thing to do. I went to because the Ferrari and Maserati were all sort of under the same umbrella,
yeah.
So we all got taken down to we all got taken to Italy to go on a driving course,
wow.
for the new Maserati 3200 that had just come out.
Oh, yeah.
And I was extremely fortunate to have Ivan Capelli as my driving instructor.
Right.
Right. I mean, you know, like this, yeah. F1 driver, and I was sat next to him in this Quattroporte, and he was taking us around. The Maserati had their own racetrack, and he was taking us around this racetrack, just drifting this Quattroporte sideways everywhere. So some of the perks that came with working at Ferrari at Greypool were super exciting, because you're meeting these different customers who, you know, they'd ring you up and say, "I want a car for the summer. What have you got?" "Well, I've got this lovely black 355 Spider." "Okay, I'll have it. Bring it down next week, and I'll make sure you get a lift home." "Okay, fine." So we'd turn up with this car, you'd present it to the new owner's right hand man, mm-hmm. And then the right hand man, he'd say, "Well, Mr. So and So has actually allocated half an hour to have some lunch. Would you like to join for lunch?" "Well, I'd love to." "Wow." "Thank you very much." So you go and have lunch, and you're sitting there overlooking Surrey, if I remember rightly. There's an incredible view. I had a wonderful lunch, and he said, "Charlie will take you home in the helicopter." "Oh, wow."
"No okay. way."
Yeah, I mean, it was just another level all of a sudden, you know, and you're meeting all these incredible people who were inspirational,
yeah.
you know, and of course you're sitting there thinking, can I do that, or can I do this, and I want to be like him, or you know, and you're always taking little bits from different people that you met, thinking, "Oh, I like the way he does that," or yeah. "I like the way he does this," and you know, we were dealing with this guy, he was Status Quo manager, and you're meeting all these incredible people, and yeah, it was an amazing thing to do. But I was so young, and I was champing at the bit to get on in life, wanted to do better and better and better. I was work, mm. you know, I was there at 6 a.m. until 8, 9 o'clock at night, no problem at all. I was young enough, I had the energy, and mm-hmm. and the drive was a 2-hour round trip each day, didn't care.
Wow.
You know, and I was snapping at everyone's heels, and the problem with it at the time was that everybody in the sort of the management structure, they'd all landed the best job in the world.
Yeah.
None of them are going to go anywhere. They're going to be there forever. And I have to say, even to this day now, I know that they are all still there.
Really?
Wow. So you know, it was, you know, push needed to come to shove, and with what I was going to do after it. But it was, yeah, it was an incredible place to be. Mm. So, and that was when I got the first F40 experience.
Right.
So Dash, God love him. Dash was the name of one of the lads that was the kind of ran the workshop. And I kept saying to him, you've got to take me out on those cars. So one day I had the knock on the door, and he said, "Come on, we're going." So I strapped, and I made strap myself into the passenger seat of this thing. Bloody hell. I mean, it feels like, and I've never, but it must feel like you've got a jet engine strapped to your back, because I'm sat in the passenger seat of this car, and Dash wasn't hanging about with the way he drove the car. It was stunning. It was just absolutely stunning. And I remember getting out of it, and I was just in absolute awe of what I just experienced. The noise, the feel, the look of the thing. I mean, everything about it was just like, oh my Lord, what was that? And I'd got a picture of, there was a picture of the F40 in the office on the wall anyway. And, you know, it was instant falling in love moment that was.
And do you think that paired up with the, you say you'd kind of become aware that the role you had at Ferrari at that point probably was as good as it was going to get. Perhaps it was you were waiting for somebody to peg it before you could replace their job, kind of thing, because they were in such a good position. So you're there thinking, chances are I'm not going to get to management position there. And then you get to experience something like that. That paired with the experience of meeting these really successful people and thinking, I want to be successful as them. And, it all come together in that car, do you think?
And I'm thinking, I've got to do my own thing.
Yeah.
I need to work for myself. And I'd always been very good with saving every penny I'd ever had. I was never frugal with going out and buying, you know, this, that, and the other. I don't need material things. I just wanted to have a good, you know, a good sort of, you know, savings so that I could use that for whatever I wanted to do. And I always wanted to have my own business, and saved all the money for that when the time was right. Mm. That, you know, that cobbled together with going and knocking on the bank manager's door saying, "I want to do this, and can you have some faith in me, please? And I know I can do it." And, mm-hmm. and that's the hardest thing to do. And I, you know, I mean, trying to, I don't know, yeah, doing it today, you know, if you had to go and see the bank manager and say, please, can I borrow, you know, X number of pounds or what have you? I mean, it's just, it must be headbanging. And if it was headbanging then, it'll be headbanging again now. But,
yeah,
you know, it's because you need people to have faith in you.
Yes.
And you've got to do what you say you're going to do and when you say you're going to do it. And, you know, and just kind of, yeah, just kind of go from there, I suppose.
And how are you with that? Because I guess a lot of people, there'll be a lot of people listening now of variants of ages. This is what I love about our listenership, is we have everything from guys and girls in their early teenage years through to people that have retired that listen to our podcast each week. And many people of all ages, more so I'd say the younger category, are either embarking on their career or they're in a position, they're in a job where they're thinking, actually, I do want to do something else. I do want to do something a bit more focused on my passion, a bit more car-centric, automotive-centric, or perhaps even run my own business. That, what was your emotion at the time of going in to see the bank manager and, as you say, selling yourself? Because I think in the modern world, this is something that a lot of people are either absolutely, they're so sort of cocksure of themselves. No, I'm brilliant. I'm going to be great. I'm going to go in with it. Or you're the complete opposite and you think, am I good enough to do this? Can you remember what your emotion was? Were you really confident in the concept?
No, I'd be more interested in the person that was worried about it than the cocksure guy. Yeah. Because, you know, all of the time, if you're not super nervous about what you're doing and you're not awake at night thinking about it, then forget it.
Yeah.
Forget it, mate, because that's you're not, it's not the right attitude to have, I don't think. Mm. I just think, and in today's world, it's so different, isn't it, about social media, Instagram, this, that, and the other, and all the rest of it. And you know, just we're constantly having to change what we do or how we do it to try and keep up with, you know, like the 20, 30-year-old people. But, I mean, when I started out, it was, you advertise in the Sunday Times, you've got a glasses guide, and off you go.
Yeah.
That's it. Auto Trader magazine, because you had a page in Auto Trader magazine. And then the website thing was just about starting to become a real force, but we were still advertising in magazines, not online.
Mm.
So the world's changed so much. So today, I think it's easier, to a degree, that if you want to start up your own business, you can just go and do it, because you only need your mobile phone.
Yeah.
So you don't need the capital behind you to do that. But if you want to do it seriously, then yeah, you're going to need to you need some money. From a confidence point of view, if you're the kind of person that sits there and thinks, oh, I'm not sure if I'm good enough, I'm not sure if I've, I'm not confident enough, or, you know, I'm worried about this, I'm worried about that, well, you're the right person, I think, because I think if you worry about it, you care about it that much, then you'll have a sharp eye for everything, and you'll be on the ball with it.
Yeah.
And for the people that are a bit too, oh yeah, I'll do this, yeah, well, okay, maybe you can. Maybe
it's about risk as well, isn't it? I think those that are nervous, they're far more likely to tread carefully. They're going to be far more conscious of risks and what could go wrong, because nobody wants to lose the business empire that they're looking at building or they have built so far. Whereas, yeah, the guys and girls that might be going into it going, it's easy, it's going to be fine, I'll just crack on with it, they're going to be a bit more risk averse.
100%, yeah.
And therefore, that's where mistakes happen and things go wrong.
Do you know what? I mean, even today, you know, we've got an opportunity to buy a car and I'm looking at it thinking, is that right?
Mm.
Is that the right thing to do now? I'm not sure. Is it the right car? Is it the right price? Is that and the other? And you're always thinking about it, because, you know, it's all about, how do I keep myself on the train tracks? Don't fall off the train tracks, you know, and just, you know, just make sure you just keep your blinkers on and just keep going in the right direction.
Yeah.
You know, if that makes sense.
I think so. Sound advice.
Yeah. I don't know.
I always hope that each episode and each conversation that we have, there's a light bulb turned on, even if it's just for one person. I know how many thousands of people will be listening to this, but if it turns on a light bulb for one person and makes them go, do you know what? I'm going to take that first step. You know, we're not saying sell everything and go and jump in with it, but if it enables you to at least register that domain page or start that social media account or start the conversations with the people that you think you need to start having them with. Just crack on with
The only thing really that is the most important part of it is that, you know, life is too short, right? Mm. So, and on the basis that you spend the majority of your life working, then make sure you enjoy it.
Yeah.
Just make sure you enjoy it. And if you don't, change it.
So true.
Yeah.
So true. And I think so many people forget it. We do have the choice.
Yeah.
We have the choice to try to at least try to make a difference.
Yeah.
I know that it's not easy to just flick a switch and walk into your dream job, but there are things you can do to start edging towards it. And happiness, as you say, is so important. Life is so painfully short. We don't know when things could change, for the better or for the worse. So if you've got the opportunity to at least have a go at something, it's worth doing. It's worth pursuing. Now, I'm going to tread delicately with this one because I know this story and I think it's absolutely brilliant. But there is an end to your chapter at Ferrari, which also was a end to a chapter in a driving license as well. So, and I will caveat this if we're going to tell the story by saying, you know, this is something that happened in the past and it's not something we advocate, but it's a bloody good story. So entirely up to you if you want to tell the story.
Okay, so I think that anybody that's really into, if you're into your motorbikes and you're into your cars and the rest of it, you know, we all like going fast, right? That's a fact, right? And when you're younger, you probably push the boundaries a little bit more than you should do, granted. And if I went back in time, would I do it again? No, I wouldn't. But I love my motorbikes, and I spent a lot of my mid-20s whizzing around Mallory Park as an instructor on track days and things like that.
Great.
And I'd quite often do the classroom thing. Yeah, good morning, welcome to Mallory Park. And here today we're going to teach you about racing lines and all of that. Did all of that. So so I was quite used to whizzing around with my knee on the floor, my elbow on the floor, and just, you know, just really going for it. Anyway, so I just bought this new GSXR 600, and I think titanium knee sliders had just become a thing, which now are frowned upon, but at the time, I think. So whenever you went round a roundabout, you stuck your knee on the floor, and you get loads of sparks from having you.
Yeah.
So, and I was meeting a pal down in Oxford, and I got home from work early, jumped on the bike, and whizzed off. And I was running the bike in. It was quite a new bike, and I got down. I was on the road that goes from Southam to Banbury, if anybody knows that, and it's a great road. And I came down to this roundabout and went round the roundabout, knee on the floor, sparks going everywhere, little wheelies came off the roundabout, and I sat behind this Honda Accord Type R. It was all done in black with tinted windows and the rest of it. And I looked at it and I thought, okay, it looks a bit different. And I looked ahead and there's a straight bit of road and everyone's cruising along very, very slowly. And I thought, so I'm going to overtake. So I pulled out, lifted the front of the bike up and wheelied past four or five cars, dropped down to the next roundabout, again whizzed around the roundabout, sparks everywhere, and I shot off. And it's a long sweeping road, and I wasn't going silly fast, but I was breaking the speed limit, but I wasn't going mental. But because it's a bike, you're going pretty quick.
Everything looks fast. And everything is dramatic.
And every time I tipped into a corner, I'm always checking my mirrors. There's nothing there, and I'm out on my own. Okay, great. I'm enjoying myself. Came into Banbury, got to a roundabout, and it shows how long ago it was. Two Vauxhall Senators, police Vauxhall Senators, blocking the road with their lights flashing. So I pulled up and I thought there's no other way through here. And I thought, okay. And I lifted my visor up and this policeman came over and he went, "You're right." And I said, "Yeah." And I said, "How long is it going to, I need to get through." And he said, "Oh, it's going to be a little while." He said, "Why don't you just get off the bike and stand over here on the grass?" I said, "Okay, fine, sure." So I got off the bike and I stood there and I looked at him and thought, "Oh, it's a helicopter." And I thought, great. I'm right in the middle of whatever's going to happen. Yeah. It's going to be really exciting with some action. And then, this policeman that I stood next to, he tapped me on the shoulder. He said, "You don't get this, do you?" And I'm like, "No." And then I looked to my right, and this Honda Accord that I'd overtaken, this black Honda Accord with all these blue lights on, this unmarked car came down the hill. I looked and I thought, "Oh no," you know. And this policeman pulled up, and he went absolutely mental at me. Sat me in the passenger seat of the car. It was all on film, of course.
Brilliant.
So apparently it was in some sort of police camera action thing at the time.
Oh really?
Well, now very badly. I got a bit of a telling off, to say the least. And of course, I got disqualified but I only had like a month ban.
Okay.
£600 fine, and you know, smack on the wrist and told him not to do it again. And I'd sold my motorbike and I was pleading, you know, what a stupid boy I was. Pretty much cost my job at Ferrari, because of course in the motor trade, if you lose your driver's license and I'd got a 2-hour commute, and it just put me in a real, real pickle. I was absolutely distraught because you know, I'd fallen off the rails. You know, the train track of life, if you like to call it, where you're trying to keep yourself, and I'd cocked up. But looking back on it, it was the shove that I needed. That I didn't, you need a shove sometimes, because I was in this great position and thinking, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And all of a sudden, I've got to do something with the rest of my life, and I'm in trouble. Mm-hmm. So I worked at another dealership very briefly, again doing the sort of more finance and management and things. And but while I was sat, I thought, no, I'm done. I need to get to do my own thing. So I bought a BMW 535i, 99 on a T registration, done 56,000 miles for something like $5,000, I think it was at the time. And sold it to a dealer for a couple of hundred quid more. And I thought, right, I can do this.
Brilliant.
I was, and I'm off. So, and it was weird because I mean, you resigned. I resigned and, yeah. and left. I thought, I've not done that before either. And then you wake up the following day thinking that I'm starting, and I'm thinking I've got a wardrobe full of suits. Mm-hmm. And I thought I can't. I'll be the only car trader to walk around in a suit. People, you know, we don't do that, and you know, and all this sort of stuff. And yeah, it's a very odd feeling.
Yeah.
You know, that first. I mean, the first year was odd, but I mean, the first week was bizarre. You know, trying to find your own way with what you're doing and setting up a company, doing all that sort of thing. I think crisis is all a bit adventurous, but. You know, yeah, but yeah. So, and all I was doing really was trading cars, which today you can't do in quite the way, in quite the volume that we did at the time. So, I was specialising in buying all the part exchanges from all the different dealerships and just swapping them all around. Which there was a few people. It was quite a thing to do, but the industry changed massively in 2005, where a lot of the dealers turned around and said, "Well, hang on, if you're selling this, you know, this." Porsche part exchange to McGurk, and he's flogging it to the Porsche dealer. Why the hell aren't you doing it? Mm. So all these sales managers are getting bollockings, and it all got very tense. And it became quite clear that they were all going to go to these auction policies, and things were going to change quite a lot. And I thought, right, you know, I've got to.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
I'm gonna have to move on again. So yeah. That's when I took this building on and created a showroom and became a retail outlet rather than a trade outlet.
Wow.
So that
in itself must have been a scary job.
Oh, huge, because all of a sudden I've got a seriously large overhead to deal with.
And you've
got to make it pay.
That's it. So, I think that is the main part that so many people, and until you've run your own business, until you've had that pressure, that stress of overheads, it's the one thing that everyone forgets about. It's like, oh, look at you, you're doing so well, you've got all these cars in stock. It's like, yeah, but I've also got all this bricks and mortar around me. At that point, had you employed anyone, or were you still a bit of a one-man band?
I'd got a guy Neil who worked for me as a driver, kind of part-time really. Mm. But we'd got quite a few drivers on the go with lots of cars buzzing around the country and what have you. But Neil was my guy at the time. And then when we took this building on, I employed Matt, who's still with us now. So it started out as myself and Neil, and then Matt was really the first full-time person I employed, and it just went on from there. Crazy really.
And what was your typical stock at that point? Because of course now you're renowned and famed for your association with selling Aston Martins. Was it Aston Martins there at the beginning? Or?
Yeah, it was. So what I should have said was that when I was at Greypool, there was never enough Ferraris to go around for people that wanted them. And we bought and sold a lot of Aston Martins at the time. So we always had like a V600 Vantage in the showroom, or a Vanquish, or DB7s. We did a lot with DB7s because they were the thing. So when I started here, the showroom was full of Porsche Boxsters, 355s, DB7s, Vanquish, and of course it all coincided nicely with the DB9 launch and with the baby V8, as it was known at the time, the Vantage. So yeah, we had all of those cars here, which is why we were called Maguette Performance Cars rather than anything else, because of course we had a bit of everything.
Yeah.
And that went on and on and on. But the more Astons we did, the more it was quite clear when you looked across the marketplace that, you know, there weren't that many modern Aston Martin specialists at that time. Mm-hmm. And there were Ferrari specialists and there were Porsche specialists. And I thought, okay, well, we'll have a go. Let's do that.
Yeah.
You kind of fall into these things, don't you?
Of course. And so did there come a time where you realised that there was a particular benefit in focusing on the Aston Martin mark over the variants of marks, or how did that happen?
Again, it was just because we were asked more and more and more, can you get me one of these? Can you get me one of those? And next thing you know, the showroom became a greater number. Mm. And then it just all kind of came together in that way, really. And all of a sudden you realise, one day I walked through the showroom and thought, Christ, I'm an Aston Martin specialist.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And look at that. And that was just kind of how it happened.
But that's often, I feel like that's from a customer and from a consumer point of view, that's almost reassuring in a sense. When you know that there is a showroom or dealership that specialises in one particular product, if you're there for that product, it's like, these guys clearly know what they're dealing with here. Therefore, they're only going to want to buy the best stock and have the best stock on offer. And when it comes to servicing and repairs or any niggly bits that need to be done, these guys are also going to know exactly what to do with it. So I think, as you say, it finds a home, doesn't it? The process kind of just does work. It does its own thing.
Indeed. And you're quite right, because, I mean, some of the weird and wonderful problems that we've had to solve here, I mean, there literally isn't anything that you don't know about them after the amount of time that we've been working on the cars. And with the combined knowledge we've got downstairs in the workshop of, Steve Pocock's been with us. Oh, he's just had his 10-year anniversary, actually. And Steve was in the main dealer network beforehand. So, but the great thing about that is that he's worked on DB7s, he's worked on Vanquish, he's worked on the Vans, he's worked on the DB9s. So all those early sort of Gegnera cars, he's done nothing but work on for the last 25 years. Steve Gray, he worked at the factory during and signed off. His signature's on under the bonnet of a lot of DB7s.
Wow.
He did a lot of work with Vanquish. He was instrumental with suspension development on DB9s. He worked on the Vard. So he's done a load of that stuff as well.
Great.
So from a knowledge-based point of view, and then James, our third technician, James has been with us for 3 or 4 years. So between the three of them, it's a really good foundation.
Mm.
Really good foundation.
Yeah.
And as always, businesses are only ever successful with the right people around you.
Oh, completely.
And Matt's been with me for 15 plus years.
Wow.
And Rob works with our sales team as well. And Rob worked with me at TWR. Actually, I worked for Rob, I should say, at TWR. And we've known each other ever since. And Lloyd helps put the workshop together in terms of controlling. And of course, we've got Andy, who looks after the our detailing, and Chris as well helps him. And really, they're a great bunch of guys.
Mm.
Really good bunch of guys. So very lucky in that respect.
And we can't forget the dog. He sadly has Watson. A day off today. Watson.
Watson's day off. Yeah, no, I know. He loves saying hello to everyone. Yeah,
yeah.
It's nice. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, I think when I came here a couple of years ago now, he was still a bit of a pup, but he was the most placid puppy I've ever met.
Yeah,
he was so chilled.
Yeah.
Perfect for, I mean, every workshop should have a dog, I believe.
Yeah, agreed.
I firmly believe that. I think it adds such a lovely dynamic. I'm trying to go through, I'm just glancing through the notes that I've got here, because there are a couple of things that are jumping out which are quite good. There's a note here that says cars in the back garden. Now, we might be going back in time a little bit here.
No, good point. So I moved. So as the business started to grow, and, it's like, I mean, everyone has storage problems now, but I had storage problems at the time because, literally hadn't got anywhere to keep the cars.
Yeah.
And the idea was that, because of the cash flow, you've got to buy it on a Monday, sell it on a Tuesday, go and buy, and just do that sort of thing. But over the weekend, there was always a period of, or even in the week, there's always a period where you've got some cars hanging around. And I lived in a house in Warwick. It was a single garage house, and I'd got room for two cars on my driveway, and I've got seven cars. Where on earth do I put them all? And I'm thinking, what on earth am I going to do? So I came up with this brainwave where I knocked down the back wall of my garage, so I could drive. so I could have like this this double garage door thing, so I could drive out the back garage and literally put them on the back garden.
Amazing!
And I could just about squeeze three cars in the back garden. And I remember one Saturday morning, going outside with the dog at the time, and I've got two 550 Maranellos parked on my lawn in the back garden. And I'm looking at it thinking, John, I need to do something about this. You know, we need to move on. But what else do you do? You know, and of course, as you're transitioning to going from trading to selling retail, you know, you're trying to sell a car from off your driveway, because what else are you going to do? And that was incredibly difficult. Neighbours were complaining because I, you know, would have a wheel refurb bloke turn up, and you know he's doing that. You know, you have to be very careful because you can't do that sort of thing. But that was really difficult. You're having a toe in the water. Can I do this? Because we're back to the have I got confidence with it, or haven't I?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I was thinking, I don't know if I can do this. Can I actually sell a car to somebody out of the paper from my driveway? And it turned out that you could. And I thought, okay, I can do this. And again, back to the confidence building thing, really.
I like that, and despite the fact that it's two 550 Maranello Ferraris, and you're still there going,
sake.
Is it going to work? Yeah. It's two 550 Maranellos there. Another of my absolute favourite. I told this story in last week's podcast, but it's a story I love, and it's that my dad, he was a Snap-on dealer, so Snap-on tools dealer, and they were running a promotion where you spend a certain amount of money, you get a little Burago scale model thing, and he brought home a F40 and a 550 Maranello, and the two sat on my bedroom shelf for years.
Amazing.
And I think just the shape of both, so very, very, two very, very different cars, but the F40 was just so radical, and it was a racing car with number plates on it, but that 550, I still look at now and think it is just such a beautiful car.
I have to say, it's one of my favourite cars. I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of the handling of the car. I'm a big fan of the way they look, the interior, that Italian interior is just, it's lovely. And if you see one in your rearview mirror, I mean, there's a big, aggressive-looking car that comes stomping up behind you. And I always remember when Clarkson did a video at Mallory Park with Tim Harvey and Richard Burns. And Richard Burns was driving the Maranello and did some, great handling with it and all that. And you can see his reaction to the grunt, the power, the torque that this thing had. They're a fantastic car. They really are. But having them in the back garden, having two of them in the back garden, my back garden, I could just about swing a cat in that and then fit these two cars in. Ludicrous.
What did the neighbours think? Because I have this beautiful vision of like a neighbour outside here mowing their lawn, maybe over the road. They see one Ferrari drive out of your garage, and then they kind of look away, look back, and then suddenly there's a completely different car driving out of the garage.
If you've got a bat cave in there, they're peering over the fence, thinking, John, what are you doing? I don't know where else to put them, really. And, quite funny.
I'd love to know about your customers. Do you have a typical customer base? Do you ever get the occasional famous face that might come through looking for cars, or what is your typical customer?
Good question. I don't think we have a typical customer particularly, but that's not true. We do. The typical customer you have is the person that dreams of owning Aston Martin. Mm. And they are buying their first Aston Martin. Mm-hmm. And they are the people that we cater for. And these people will go on to their dream. They want to go and buy a new car eventually. But we are the stepping stone to that. And so you have everybody here from the person that turns up with their spreadsheet. They're worried about cost. They're worried, can I afford this? Can I afford that? And you're sitting them down and talking them through affordability. You have the couple that turn up. He might have just sold his business. They've done great. They want to treat themselves. You've got the retired people, and then you've got the young guy that's doing great, and he wants one too. And it's a mixed bag of people. We do have the odd familiar face, the odd famous face that comes and buys cars, and everyone's. We're so lucky. I don't know what it is about Aston Martin, but it attracts lovely people. Mm. And we're very lucky that our clients are all great people, and they're just out to have a nice car. But we're very much the kind of business that, once they've bought the car, it's how can we look after them going forward?
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll see you next year for a service. But if anything happens in the meantime, you know, we'll be our give us a call. We'll have, and we'll always, you know, we'll always do anything and everything we can. There is one story that's just come to mind. I remember a few years ago we had this young guy, and he said, I want to propose to my girlfriend.
Ooh.
And I want to, I always wanted an advantage, and I want to drive it to the Alps, and I want to propose at the top of the Stelvio Pass or what have you, and do all this sort of stuff. He said, but I'm really, really worried that something's going to go wrong with the car.
I feel like this is very much his vision here, not hers.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, she had no idea. And you can see he's in the show, and he's like, I really, really want to do it, but what if it breaks down? And what if? And what if? And what if? And what if?
Mm.
And I said, well, I don't know what you want me to say, because if I tell you it's going to be all right, it clearly won't be all right.
Mm.
All we can do is we can do absolutely everything we can do to make sure, right here, right now, that it's going to be okay. I said, but I can't give you any more assurance. I mean, it would be wrong of me to give you any more assurances other than that. Anyway, after some time of deliberating, he said, okay, this is days and weeks. He said, I'm going to go for it, but can you just make sure that it doesn't break down on me and it's going to be all right? I have to say, I mean, as you say, we sell 200 cars a year. They're great. We wouldn't be doing it if they weren't, sort of thing. Anyway, so he set sail. And I had a phone call on the Friday night, and he's in pieces. He's in Nice, in the south of France. I've got an engine light, come on. It's an emissions warning light, you know, which is normally like a lambda sensor in the exhaust or something. And I said, look, don't worry about it. It'll be okay. And all that. So I'm trying to, because he was in absolute tatters. And he said, well, what can you do? What can you do? What can you do? And I said, right, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. So I got one of my technicians on an aeroplane with the spare parts. I flew him to Nice. We fixed the car in the hotel car park overnight. Oh, and the following day, he got in the car and drove up the mountain, did the thing. It was all fine, you know. and he came home, and he's just like, you know, best mates ever since, sort of thing.
Brilliant.
It's so difficult, isn't it? Because you can never guarantee anybody that something won't go wrong. And when someone says to you, can you guarantee? It's like, no, I absolutely can't guarantee it. We had to pull the stops out for that guy and just make sure.
Incredible. I take it she said yes.
100%.
Yeah.
100%. I think we'd have all been a bit upset
if she imagined.
Yeah, if she hadn't.
Yeah, thanks for fixing the car. Sadly, she said no. But never mind. Yeah, no, that's good. That's amazing. Yeah, love stuff like that. But as you say, yeah, that added pressure, the idea of anyone coming in and going, just so you're aware, this is going to be used for a trip which is going to be probably the most memorable of my life. Please make sure nothing goes wrong.
The most thing in the world.
What?
I know.
What are you supposed to do?
And the minute he came out with it, I thought, how can this possibly go right? You know, you've gone and jinxed it before we've even begun. But we got there in the end.
Indeed.
You know.
So let's now jump on to car ownership, because, of course, we started with that brilliant story of the first cars, and I'm sure, again, a lot of people will be nodding along and thinking, yep, had that. Well, I had one of those, did exactly that same thing. I love the idea of watching your two mini headlights disappear over the Coventry Ring Road. But it's now got to a point where things are going okay, aren't they? And you've been able to buy a few cars that are quite special. We'll start with that gorgeous F40, which, again, I'm looking at a photo of it now. How did you come about owning an F40?
So when we had the last recession, 2008, 2009 and what have you, at that time, F40s were worth a great deal less than they are now, along with F50s, along with 288 GTOs and lots of other cars. Mm. We were buying and selling probably four F40s a year, a couple of F50s, and I remember we did two or three 288 GTO deals. But as we were, got to 2010 and 2011, and every time we sold an F40, to buy the next one, you had to pay £50,000 more than you sold the last one for. And, you know, and because we just come out of a recession and everyone's super nervous about everything, and again, we're back to having the confidence and about, how do we feel about it all? I'm ringing the bank manager saying, well, the next car's going to cost X. And he's like, really? And I'm like, yeah, and the prices were jumping. And it got to the end of the year, and I thought, if I sell this car, I can't afford to buy the next one, because we've got the showroom full of cars, and my pockets weren't deep enough. And so I rang the bank manager and said, I'm going to keep it. How do you feel about that? You know, and we had this massive conversation about what to do with this car. I just turned up with it at home on the driveway. And I said, wow. I said, Carol, we're keeping this one.
Meet our new car.
Yeah, she's like, really? I said, yeah, I think so. I think it's the right thing to do. I think so. And that was it. And we've done 30,000. It's just clicked 30,000 kilometres.
Wow.
It is the most exciting thing. And every time you get in it, it's always an adventure. It's always an experience. It is a classic car. They're not perfect. I could give you a list of things that I'm not happy with, that are wrong with it. But to hell with it all, because when you're in it and you're driving it, it's the car that's... Yeah, I remember JK from Jamiroquai nicknamed his Miss Whiplash. It's a great description because they are dangerous. They will bite you, and you've really, really got to be very clear-headed when you get in the car, because the slightest little movement of the throttle, the boost, all of this sort of stuff, you know, it will stick you in the hedge. I mean, the car wants to put you in the hedge almost, you know, potholes and things. It dances around all over. You've got to have two hands on the steering wheel. You've got to hang on to it all the time. You've really got to concentrate. But the reward you get from all of that is through the roof. It really is. It's exhilarating. The noise it makes is just heart stopping. It's great.
Yeah,
it's really great. Yeah,
I think the best description I ever heard from a fellow F40 owner was again using superbikes as a kind of comparison. So it's a bit like riding a ridiculously powerful superbike in the rain. You're constantly waiting for something to happen, a wheel to jump or something, and you end up looking and watching the road in the same way that you do on a superbike.
Oh, 100%, yeah.
You're looking at road surfaces, you're looking at manhole covers, you're looking for mud, cow pat, that sort of, anything that might alter.
It will upset the car.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's exactly right. It's a great way of looking at it, and I couldn't agree more. The slightest little flutter in the road will change the direction of the car. Because they are super sensitive, and, you know, they're so basic, there's no help with these cars whatsoever, and they're not the fastest thing on the road by quite some stretch, but my God, they're the most exciting. They really are. I'm super lucky, you know, and that thing's like part of the family, you know. Carol and I used it as their wedding car, you know, and that sort of thing, and it really means something to all of us, it really is a thrilling. It's thrilling. I'm such a lucky bloke to have that car. It's great. Yeah,
that's good. I'm glad you say that, because I think everyone listening will be like, "What a lucky bloke to own that car." So I'm glad you realise it.
Yeah,
as well.
No, look, you know, and really, I mean, the daft thing is, or the thing that's kind of makes it awkward is the value of it becomes to such a point it's worth more than my house by quite some stretch. You know, and, well, why don't you sell it and get a bigger house? Well, yeah, but I love the car.
Yeah.
And I do love it.
Yeah.
You know.
The house can't take you on adventures. Whereas the car
No, it can't. And again, it's the same scenario. If you sell it, you know, will I have another one? Nah, no way.
Yeah.
You know.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital.
It seems to be for me an ever disappearing dream, because they're just becoming so expensive now.
Yeah.
Unless something very amazing happens, like I decide to buy a lottery ticket and win.
To give you an idea, when I was at Greypool, I remember we bought one for 90 grand.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So
Well, I can remember being, what would I have been, 17, 18, 19, my first proper job out of college, having walked out of it. I went into property and estate agency, and of course, as you do at that point, you start earning money at that age and going, right, a few years of doing this and I'll buy myself something really cool. And I can remember, I think it was probably the Joe Macari website, because I was working at Wimbledon and the Joe Macari showroom was only up the road in Wandsworth. And I think he at that time had two, and they were both, I think one was 275 and one was 300,000. And I remember saying in the office then, so we're talking 2008, 9 here, saying, I had a colleague in the office also called John, and I said, I bet these are going to be £1 million someday. And he's, no, they won't. But they are now, aren't they? They're kind of going into auctions with estimates of £1 million. One might have even sold recently for more.
It's all getting a bit, it's all getting a bit over the top, really. But it is what it is. The car market's had two very, very strong years. So there's, and I think post post COVID, there's a lot of life's too short, and you know, what the hell, and all that sort of stuff. And you know, quite rightly so.
Yeah,
I think we've all. I mean, I have, and you know, we've all sat down and at home, and said, what do we want to do this year? Mm-hmm. You know, how many boxes do we want to tick as a family and go off and do X, Y, and Z? And you know, and people saying, well, I've always wanted that Aston Martin. I've always wanted this, that, and the other. And get on with it. Now's the time,
So if you notice that in your sales, then through people inquiries, it's. Yeah. Because I guess that was a big thing, again, for everyone in the automotive world. When we started, when the pandemic first hit and suddenly we were put into lockdown, I think a lot of people became really uncertain. They were like, oh, God, do I need to sell the cars? Does everything need to go away? Because it was so uncertain about
honestly,
what was happening.
It was like looking down the barrel of a shotgun.
Yeah.
You know, we closed on the 24th of March. I remember being stood outside here when everyone was getting the cars going home, and I was looking at the sky thinking, oh my Lord, where's this going to go?
Yeah.
You know, because we've got all stock invested, we've got the properties and bits and pieces that are rented out. What if he goes bust? What if my tenant leaves? And, what's going to happen to the value of this, that, and the other? And it is, you're thinking, oh, where's it all going to go? Through COVID, it was really difficult for lots of different industries. But for some reason, the automotive industry survived quite well.
Yeah.
And I think it was largely to do with people thinking, to hell with this. I'm going to have that car.
Correct.
Yeah, and why not?
So did you find that was pretty instant? Once you were allowed to get back to work and business was going, I know that a lot of people, especially businesses that did a lot of business selling aftermarket parts like alloy wheels and exhaust systems and stuff, suddenly they were booming because there were loads of people sat at home, not working, getting furlough payments.
Yeah.
The money that they would usually be spending on the pub is just still there.
Yeah.
So they were going out buying new wheels, buying exhaust pipes. Did you see it on the grander scale then as well?
Yeah.
The people that had that money sat in the bank, perhaps waiting for that rainy day fund, going, do you know what? Screw this. I'm getting a DB9. I've always
100%.
Wanted one. Brilliant.
Yeah, it took about 5 months, post-March. We came back in first week of May, I think it was, and we were flat out straight away from there on in, which was just it was bizarre. It's like the world's just had a month off.
Yeah,
what else going on? We've all had a month off, or we were locked out, whatever. But and now all of a sudden it's just we're going again. It's crazy.
Yeah, incredible. Now, besides the F40, what else have you currently got in your personal collection?
Back to when I was working in the hotel, and I used to drive into Coventry and back every day, and I always used to go past a business called PMR Construction, a guy called Pete Ratcliffe, and Pete had a bright red Escort RS Cosworth, and parked outside where he worked, and every day I used to drive past and look at that car and think, oh wow, that's amazing. And again, back to the Max Power thing, back to the Jeremy Clarkson, and everyone was ranting and raving about Cosworths, and could never afford one, certainly couldn't afford the insurance or the car. About 7 or 8 years ago, and I've been looking for ages to try and find a really nice one that hadn't been messed about with, that hadn't been crashed and stolen and the rest of that, and I found this really lovely red car. And I've had that for sort of 7 or so years, and again, we've done a few miles in that. That's really nice. I've got a Mark 1 Golf. Which is
another one.
Yeah, it's a bit of neither here nor there, really. It's a kind of a track spec, fast road kind of car. Again, I put a 20 valve engine in it rather than blah blah blah. And that's kind of fun. What else have I got? During lockdown, I bought a DB5, really special car, left hand drive example, which is really rare. They built about 147 cars, and it needed restoration. So I bought that, and we spent about 18 months restoring that, and that's just been finished. So that's beautiful, California Sage. It's just a stunning, stunning thing. But of course, I think the most exciting car, and I know you're just itching to talk about it, is our 1972 Rolls-Royce Silver Shadow.
Brilliant.
Which looks like a proper, it's a rat look car, isn't it?
Yep.
I think you'll agree. So for those of you that haven't seen a picture of it, we've got a little bit about it on our website, but it's, so this car started life as Robert Maxwell's car. The recent House of Maxwell series on the BBC He was filmed in the back of the car and all the rest of it. Mm. For some reason, and there's something going on with it, I'll never find out, but he was the only registered keeper of it until March last year.
Uh-huh.
So it's been kept in some sort of thing, trust or whatever, I don't know.
Yeah.
At some point, they'd flattened the paint back to respray the car, stopped halfway through and left it. So it's just got, and it's been left like for 20 years. So it's got this amazing faded paintwork with some primer on down one side and not on the other side. And someone's pinched the flying lady off the front of it. And, and it just looks like a banger. Yeah. Which for a Rolls Royce is just got to be one of the best, coolest looks ever. And I bought this at auction last year. And I got it back and I bought it blind. And I got it back and we looked at it and thought, what on earth have I gone and done? And we connected a battery up to it, turned the key, and everything worked.
Really?
Honestly, I couldn't believe it. Everything worked. And then, so then I'm thinking, well, if all that works, the lights, and I mean, even the electric seats are still working. And of course, when I'm looking in the bonnet, and then, so we had the spark plugs out, and next thing you know, it's turning over. I'm thinking, here we go. So we had to do a load of work to fuel tanks, fuel lines. Yeah. Carburetors. Well, I mean, we did all of it, and it's passed its MOT with no advisors a couple of weeks ago.
Brilliant.
Would you believe? So, although it looks horrendous, or actually, it looks great. However you want to look at it, but it's got all new brakes, new tyres, everything underneath the car's new. Mm. It's a really funky thing to drive. I mean, it's a bit daft and a bit silly, honestly, I know, but it's just kind of cool.
It's one of those. I think it's on everyone that would classify themselves as a true petrol head, I think a slightly ratty old roller or even an old Bentley, it's kind of up there with that ultimate pub car, isn't it? Get your mates in the back, cruise down to the pub, just sit outside in the pub garden or go down to Caffeine and Machine, which of course is only down the road from here, and just sit on a bench and just admire it with a pint in hand.
But it's the irony of this car that once upon a time would have been absolutely the bee's knees in the British motor industry.
Yeah.
And Rolls-Royce still are, of course. But to now sit and look at that car in that state as a fully functioning, running, and it is, I mean, it wafts down the road. It's silent. I mean, the build quality of that car is second to none, clearly. Mm. And Rolls-Royce was super helpful. We've spoken to them about it, and they've sent through all of the original paperwork with Maxwell's signature when he bought it from Jack Barclay that was in Oxford. And,
wow.
Yeah, it's been. There's loads of. It's quite interesting, you know.
And are you going to paint it, or are you just going to leave it as it is?
No. It's got to stay looking like that, because that's the whole. If you painted it, no one would bat an eyelid at it.
Yeah, that's true.
You know,
that's
and. True. It's not. I mean, as a car, it's not worth a great deal at all, I don't think. But it's just. You'd have to go. You'd have to put a lot of time and effort in to create that look on any car, let alone on a car like a Rolls Royce.
Yeah,
you know
that's true. Yeah, you paint the you paint it and it immediately, half the story's gone, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think so.
Now, fill in a gap here because I don't know the answer to this. I've got the note here that says XJ220. Are you the owner of an XJ220, or is there a story to an XJ220? Because I feel like I have seen.
Owned an XJ220. Yeah. I don't own one now, but I so pre F40 again. XJ220s at the time were £70,000 or thereabouts.
Wow.
So 2008, I bought this beautiful one owner. It was left hand drive actually, done 1,000 kilometres. And a gorgeous car, and I was always the butt of everyone's jokes because I commuted to work and back in it, and
brilliant.
You know, and everyone and like some of the local car guys around here, they were like, "Is that your daily run around?" You know, but it was because they're such a drivable car. I mean, they're a massive; it's a big car, right?
Yeah.
So when you have the whole F40 XJ220 comparison, F40 is a go kart, the XJ220 is a much bigger, heavier thing, but. If you wanted to go on a longer journey, the Jag has got, you know, a lovely interior, great aircon, great hi-fi system, you know. So they've both got pluses and minuses, but the Jags are so rare.
Mm.
And, you know, whenever you're out in either car, to be honest, you know, if you go down the M40 and you're sitting in lanes one or two, you'll always get somebody coming past, hanging out the window with the camera, taking photographs of it, because it's such a rare thing to spot. But the Jag was a great car, and I had that for a couple of years, but it went to make room for the F40. Mm. I'm a big fan. They're a love-hate car, I know that, and some people can't stand the sight of them, but the story behind it's really cool. And again, going back to growing up in Coventry, you know, when they were developing the car, and they were using the A45 as their test track. Yeah. So when they had the white van with the XJ220 running gear in it, you know, you'd spot that driving up and down the A45, and thinking, what's going on there? And you know, so there's lots of those cars. It's an exciting story.
Yeah. And would you say, looking back on your time with the 220, what would you say? What is it that makes the F40 just so special over that? Like, or if the opportunity came up and someone said, "Oh, hey, I've got one and it's a reasonable price," do you think you'd be tempted to get another one, another XJ, or?
No, I lots of things that going on, alarms go off in my head. Probably couldn't afford to have it as well as, to have two cars. The problem is if you've got loads of cars, you never, you know, you want to have one car and enjoy one car.
Yeah,
says the man that's got three or four. But you know, but you've just got to have a smaller number of cars rather than having 10 cars, because you just never get to use them properly and really enjoy them. And I think, you know, I had great time with the Jag and I did that. So, but I haven't got any massive leaping desire to go back and do it again. I'd rather be in the F40, frankly.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
And going on then, before we wrap things up, to the other end of the spectrum, is there anything you have on your wish list still that you think, even if it's not in the immediate future, but a certain car or two, or a bike perhaps, that you think, God, I'd love to have one of those at some point. If all the stars align in the right way and I have the means to do it, is there something that's on that dream list?
No.
Ah.
Do you know what? I'm not a huge fan of the modern technology cars. There's too many driver aids and things with them and all the rest of it. And as I sit here right now, I must admit, I haven't driven anything that's been that new for quite some time. So I'm probably a little bit off the pace with it. But there's lots of cars I'd like to have a drive of, but I haven't got anything thumping away that I'd really like. But do you know what? I saw a picture of the other day. And this is going to sound completely off the wall, but the Dodge Hellcat.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Oh God, they look a complete animal. I mean, it's such a different thing, and I like different, you know. But those Hellcats look, I mean, they just look so aggressive. I've never had an American muscle car, and it's just something I've not done. It's a box I'd like to tick, you know, they're very. They're very straight line. I think they're probably overpowered, really. But I must admit, I do look at those and think they look wicked. You know, I'd love to have a go in one of those. But you know, some of the new cars that are coming out, just I don't know. Everything's going so electric in terms of battery powered and bits and pieces, The costs associated with battery replacement if it goes wrong, and you look at the, I mean, like running the F40, right? I mean, people might be thinking, well, how much is that? It's pennies by comparison. It's not an expensive car to look after. I mean, we've done a lot of the servicing work here. Bob Houghton looks after it for me too. Servicing costs are about £1,500. I mean, it's not an expensive car to own and to maintain, right? But some of these new cars, you know. Like the LaFerraris, and they need new batteries, and they're 50 plus thousand quid or whatever it is. Yeah. And I'm thinking, oh my Lord, where's that going? And I like the cars that don't need to rely on that kind of expenditure at some point. Mm. One of the cars that I own that I forgot to mention, I've got to mention it, because this is all about, you know, being silly about cars and fun factors. A Citroën Mahari.
Oh, yeah.
Right. So if you don't know what a Citroën Mahari is, it's basically, think of a 2CV. So it's a Citroën Dayan chassis with a 2CV engine and running gear. It's like a beach buggy sort of thing, and it's only ever good for a country with a good climate. But I've got one that I've owned it for 3 years. It's a plastic tub on wheels with suspension. If it rolls over too hard, you'll all fall out of the car at a corner. And it's so slow, it's hilarious. But the fun factor of that car, I mean, and because cars are all about fun, I just believe that if you're a proper car person, that it's no good saying to me, oh yeah, no, I love Porsche. I've got a GT3, I've got a Cayman, and I've got a Macan.
Yeah.
what? So you've got three Porsches. That's it. And I think that you should just have lots of different stuff and appreciate lots of different stuff. So going from an old knackered Rolls Royce to a Mahari to an F40 to a, you know, to a whatever. I don't know. For me, that's what flicks my switch. And there's nothing really brand new on the market that I'm, you know, desperately climbing the walls for. I'm quite a happy, content bunny, really.
Yeah,
I think.
So let's look ahead to the future then. What is your, obviously we're in this really fascinating, transformative time in the car industry at the moment, especially with new cars. We're edging closer and closer towards full electrification, or at the very least, cars having to be sold with some sort of hybrid, plug-in hybrid technology within the car. Are you excited about the future of cars? And what do you think, if the answer to that is no, what do you think might be the redeeming factor?
Who knows where this is going to go? So I think that we'll end up having a choice of car in the future. So it's not just going to be electric. Hydrogen's clearly a thing. Mm-hmm. That's clearly happening. I know that ProDrive want to race a hydrogen-powered car at Le Mans in the not-too-distant future. Yanmar are a big marine company, because I'm, again, being a petrol, I love boats and stuff. Mm-hmm. Yanmar have just done an Atlantic crossing with a hydrogen-powered boat. So I think in the future we're going to have some choices about what to do if the combustion engine, or when the combustion engine, gets sidelined. What I'm struggling to understand with electric vehicles is, you know, everyone says, "Oh, it's I'm doing my bit for the environment," and I understand that you're doing your bit for the environment once you're in the car and driving down the road, because you've got a zero emission car at that point. But the reality of it is that to put that car together, we've got precious metals that have been mined from Lord knows where. They've been transported on some smelly ship to California. It's all been put together in California. Then another big smelly ship's transported all of that around the world. There's parts on aeroplanes everywhere. So up until the point that car actually gets on the road, you're not doing the world any favours whatsoever, in my eyes, as far as I can see it. I don't get it up until that point. And what bothers me after that is that you put the car on the road and the slightest of side impacts will write the car off because you damage the battery. The batteries can't be repaired. Yep. Once the batteries can't be repaired, what happens to them? I don't know. Mm. And I'm sure there's an answer out there somewhere, I just don't know. And how is that recycled? Because, you know, the batteries are like nuclear waste inside there. I mean, it's horrible stuff. So do you remember the Cook Report? You might not. Years ago, there's a guy called Peter Cook. He was an investigative journalist. And there was someone always had a hit out on this guy because he just upset everybody.
Yeah.
But would go off and actually find out the truth about this and the truth about that. And I'm waiting for somebody like Peter Cook to re-emerge and say, this is the truth about electric vehicles, and this is what they really do and what they really don't do. Mm-hmm. And it's so hard to be properly educated about it, because you read so many different things in the press about, you know, about the precious metals and about this and about that, and about the lithium in the batteries, and what do we do with it, and I don't know. Mm. And there's lots of different things that you can read, and I'm sure that it is all recyclable and the rest of it. But, you know, when you've got that damaged Tesla or electric vehicle or what have you at the side of the road that's just been written off because the repair costs are so great, you know, and now you've got to recycle this car. So if you want to be really good to the environment, why aren't we recycling what we've already got rather than keep producing new?
Yeah.
Question. Yeah. So why aren't we like the Rolls Royce Silver Shadow, right? I mean, it's not saying it's case in point, but just for the sake of conversation, that's a 1972 car. Yes, it's grossly unfriendly in terms of what comes out of the exhaust on it for the 500 miles a year it'll probably do.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just been rebuilt with all recycled parts.
Yeah.
So what does the future hold with all of the electric things and the hydrogen things and all the rest of it? And I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a head scratcher. Obviously, the electric vehicles with the network of charging cars and points, that's still got a long, long, long way to go. Is that actually ever going to happen? I'm not sure. There's loads of questions. I just don't know the answers to, in all honesty. But it's kind of fascinating.
Yeah. No, I think many people listening will be in absolute agreement with you, me being one of them again, because, of course, it has been proven time and time again that ability to keep an old car on the road, you know, even thinking back to the Rolls Royce, thinking back to a couple of cars that I had from the late 1990s, those cars, the carbon dioxide that's been used to make those cars has been and gone. It's done. It was done in the 1990s. It was done in the 1970s. And the cost the carbon cost per car at that time was drastically smaller than it is now to make these new electric cars. And as you say, you write off your Tesla, what's going to happen? Oh, and the insurance will pay you out and you get another one.
Yeah. And where's the help in that? I don't get it.
Exactly. And the amount of carbon that is produced now from creating electric cars and, as you say, shipping them around the world, flying parts around the world, it is not an environmentally friendly option. Okay, if we are in a world where perhaps it will happen, but it's not going to be for 20 or 30 years, where everything is renewable power. Everything's wind, solar, wave, tide. You think of green energy, green electricity that's being generated, and somehow some sort of amazing technology has been developed to recycle those precious metals that are in the batteries. Yes, we might get there, but that is such a long way away from now. So the right here, right now, this people, you know, campaigning about, oh, I'm saving the planet because I'm driving around in my Tesla or
Prius.
Or
I just don't get it.
No.
You know, I mean, the dark thing is the carbon footprint of my mobile phone is probably greater than the carbon footprint of that old Rolls Royce.
Yeah,
over the last 10 years.
Yeah.
So, I think it's something that the government, you know, we had the, you know, go and buy a diesel car.
Yeah.
You know, go and buy an electric car. Have you actually properly sat down and done your homework about it? No, you haven't.
No,
you haven't. And it needs to be done in a way that is categorical and, you know, without any doubt and question. And so let's educate people so that everyone can understand where it's going. Because I just don't agree that it's as great as everyone's making it out to be.
No.
You know, but and you know, a lot of the older cars. I mean, everyone needs a daily runaround that is a friendly, environmentally friendly car. 100%, I get that. And everyone that's got, you know, older cars, like my cars are all a lot older, and their carbon, you know, that comes out of the exhaust, not good for the environment. But if you're only doing 500, 1,000, 2,000 miles a year, not the end of the world.
No.
Right? So, but it's the car that's doing 20,000 miles a year, 30,000 miles a year, 40,000 miles a year. They're the ones that need to be friendly to the environment, 100%. But I just don't think that the government have looked at it properly.
No, and there are many people out there, whether this is factually correct or not, but there are many people out there that have given the opinion that, in actual fact, again, running an older car like that that's already had its carbon used up from the construction process, the actual fueling of that car, if you are going to be doing 1,000 miles a year at most, maybe even 5,000 miles a year at most, you're actually, from a carbon dioxide point of view, you're efficiently using the fuel that's being put into that car, i.e. you put 500 litres of fuel into that car every year. You burn 500 litres and you get the 500 litres worth of offset from carbon dioxide that comes out the back. Looking at the national grid and the electricity process that we have at the moment, the way that electricity is generated and put into cars, you know, battery life fades when cars aren't used. In the same way, like if you don't use your mobile phone for 6 months and you've plugged it in and charged it, the battery life drains. The same thing happens in cars. So suddenly that carbon has been created by burning coal in power stations in order to generate that electricity that's gone into a product that then might just fade away. So how does that become more environmentally friendly than just burning the exact percentage that we know of carbon dioxide that's going to come out of an engine that's been used for that purpose? You know, we can sit with our fuel in the fuel tank for 6 months. Okay, the octane might drop slightly, but it will still get burnt and used, whereas it's not going to just mysteriously fade away as if we'd left the fuel cap off.
Yeah, and you know, and the other problem I think that's going to arise with electric vehicles is, let's say you've got an electric vehicle that is, it's done 100,000 miles, it's 8 years old, so you've got no battery warranty, and you'd be a brave person to go and buy that vehicle with the possibility of battery replacement looming over you, and then again, how's that going to work? You know, it's not like you can drive it into a service centre, they pull one battery out, stick another one in, and off you go, sir. Yeah. If the cost of the battery replacement is so vast, the car will be a write-off again, surely. So I don't know, I don't know. I'm not a battery electric vehicle guy, so I'm sure there'll be people listening that know answers to these questions, but I don't. But yeah. I just. That's just kind of how I interpret it for now, I suppose. Yeah.
And if there is anyone listening that thinks, actually, no, I got the information that you guys need, then feel free to send us an email, podcast@drivenchat.com. If you think you can justify this new world of EVs to us, then chances are I might want to rock up with some microphones and have a chat with you, because I'd like to know. I'd like to learn.
Me too.
What are we missing?
Yeah, you know? Me too.
That's what we'd like to know. So, podcast@drivenchat.com if you'd like to get in contact with the show. I've taken an hour, nearly an hour and 40 minutes of your time.
Oh, we've done well.
We've done very well, haven't we? I'm going to quickly glance over my notes just to check. There's nothing else I've missed that's really, really worth us talking. Obviously, everything we've talked about is worth it. I've got your amazing list of motorbikes here as well. Bandit 600, CBR 600, GSXR, Bandit 1200. You got bigger with the Bandits. Fireblade, Ducati Scrambler, Hypermotard. Yeah. Some amazing cars and bikes you've had, isn't it?
Yeah, no, very, very, a very lucky boy with all of that, really. But you know, for anybody that's kind of car, bike, engine crazy, you know, if you're into it, you're into it, aren't you?
Yeah, so. Exactly that. Now, if people want to find out a bit more about you, and more importantly about the business, if there's somebody at home thinking, actually, yeah, I have got that spare allocation of funds sat in the bank doing nothing, and I really do quite fancy an Aston, what's the easiest way for people to find you?
As always, through our website, which is mcgurk.com, and there's lots of links on there for getting in touch with us. And we are an open house. So if you are passing, if you do want to come and see us, have a cup of tea and walk around, you are very, very welcome indeed.
Awesome. Yeah, and it is an incredible showroom. And tucked away at the back of the showroom, if you're very lucky, you might see a particular red Ferrari looking very shiny, albeit maybe under a cover. But if you ask John very nicely, the cover might come off. And
always.
Get a quick
always.
Minute.
Always.
Fantastic. Well, John, thank you so much for your time. It's
no
been
pleasure.
Fantastic. I'm sorry this has taken a ridiculous amount of years to actually come together, but I'm glad it has. And I have no doubt that we will cross paths again very soon. And perhaps as time goes on, we'll come back for another chat. If we've got something quite cool, particular project or something worth talking about, then we'll come in and have a chat with you.
Yeah, definitely.
As well.
Thanks, John.
Thanks so much. Thank you very much, dear listener, for joining us for this week's episode. As always, you can find out everything that we do at drivenchat.com. You can see all of the videos that we put together on YouTube, and of course you can find the entire back catalogue wherever you are listening to this podcast in the same place. The only other thing I'd like to say, which again sounds a bit sort of self-righteous and pleading, is if you do have the time, means, ability and desire to leave us a positive review, it does help us no end. So if you're listening on Apple Podcasts and you've got a second to spare, just to write us a positive review, it does really does do amazing things in an algorithm machine that none of us can really understand, but it's a huge help to us. If that's the only thing you do to thank us for this podcast, then it will be much appreciated. For now, I'll leave you at that, and I will look forward to speaking to you again with another episode, which I can promise you will, again, for the third week in a row, reference F40s. And that's because next week I'm talking to Sam Moores, who has also been a very lucky owner of a Ferrari F40. But more on that and more from Sam next week. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
The Driven Chat podcast in association with Paramex Digital. You dream it, we bring it to life. Find out more at drivenchat.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Oh, wow, you've made it to the end, the very end. And it's John Markar here again, reminding you that this podcast, the Driven Chat podcast, has now run its course and has come to an end. To find the new format, search the Driven podcast in your preferred podcast app or head on over to the website driven.site to find some quick and easy links through to the new episodes in the new formats on your preferred apps. Thanks. Bye.